Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about Wild West RPGs. You know, some experts say that the Wild West genre was the very first RPG, arguably. So we're wondering, how did that legacy affect D&D and other role-playing games that came later? All that and more today on Wandering DMs. I'm so excited for this, Paul.
Yeah, me too. It's interesting because I've never really thought that critically about the fact that this really is like the number two setting for RPGs or possibly number one. My head always goes to sci-fi really quickly, but I guess we were discussing this just prior to the show, and I guess it took a while, right, for a purely sci-fi RPG to hit the shelves. Right,
it's kind of surprising how many years, yeah. Sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Or Planet and Sword and Planet gaming was in there, and it took a surprising number of years to get a spacefaring, you know, Star Warsy, Star Trekky type game in the mix, and other stuff came first, like Wild West. Wow. So I got to thank our patrons, Paul, for this is another topic that came up in our Sunday conversation post show, actually on our Discord server. So big thanks to our patrons for bringing this up. Like, as usual, kind of like a fish in the water, it's not something I would have thought of myself. But the other thing is I actually tripped up. It's interesting because I tripped up over the terminology a little bit. Initially, I was calling this episode Western RPGs, and a number of people were confused, thinking that we're going to contrast this with like Japanese RPGs or something like that. And I had to switch the naming so I wasn't confusing people accidentally. So that was kind of interesting. And of course the comment was like, don't you guys just talk about Western RPGs all the time? Aren't you always talking about American RPGs? How is this any different? So I had to fix that. And thank you for people for pointing out the vocabulary issue.
Yeah. Maybe we should do an episode at some point about non-American RPGs. Fascinating.
Gonna write that. That one I'll have to do more research on, frankly, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. But I'm writing it down.
Yeah. For Wild West setting, you know, I was surprised to realize that I actually do have some background in this. Not in the classic one that we're probably all of our old school viewers are thinking, which of course is Boot Hill, sort of your classic TSR game that came out. My background is more actually in the game Deadlands, which I played very early in its lifespan. I was just at my bookshelf pulling out the original Deadlands book to try and remind myself when the heck did this game even come out, and the answer was 1996. So I was surprised that it was that early. I guess a little surprised, but not really, because I remember playing it in college. So
interesting.
Yeah.
What do you want to talk about first? You want to dig into Boot Hill? You want to dig into Deadlands? And then and maybe let's, after let's that, we can dig into some other games that people have told us about recently.
Yeah. Let's talk about Boot Hill, because, I mean, might as well go chronologically, right? Although I can't say that. I'm going to lean on you on this one, Dan. I don't really have much experience with Boot Hill.
Got my second edition book here in pretty good shape, actually. My box is gone. I played Boot Hill maybe about a year, two, as a player, mostly, in a campaign. I think when I was like in junior high school or something like that. Historically, and so I'm familiar with what's technically the second edition of the game. There was a first edition of the game that was very, very minimalist. There was just a booklet, and then they had a second edition that came out in a box with a big map, came with dice. Actually, it came with these dice, as a matter of fact. So I got these, right, it's percentile dice, and this is the era before the D10 was invented. So it was still coming with, D20s that just had 0 to 9 twice on them. You can see that these are very well-used dice. They're pretty close to round at this point. And, you know, historically, right, D&D came out in 1974, right? And then there was also the little-known Warriors of Mars game, and then Empire of the Petal Throne the next year that we were talking with James Malajewski about last week, and then Boot Hill. So all within the first year, those were the first four games, at least from TSR, was D&D Warriors of Mars, based on the Burroughs John Carter books, and EPT, and then Boot Hill. So right in the first couple months, this was one of the main games. So I liked it. You know, obviously it's got a more historical vibe to it. And in the second edition book, they have like a large appendix of the statistics of real world historical people in the Wild West, actually go on for at least 5 or 6 pages of that stuff. So there's a lot of historical stuff. The weapons list is a very long list of firearms with, you know, how many rounds are in it, the range, the date that it became available. So you would set your campaign of like, are you 1865 or are you 1875? Because actually that's going to change the equipment available a lot. So of course this was in the moment, right, where when Boot Hill was originally made, this was in the moment when they were still making this shift from war games, right? So initially, right, D&D is advertised as a war game. Boot Hill first edition is basically a war game that happens to be where you're just controlling one person at a time. And they hadn't come up with the word, the phrase role-playing until second edition. You can see on the box cover here. So it very much starts off as a war game. Yep.
I suppose that's what modern gamers would refer to as sort of a squad-based war game, where you're probably like emulating shootouts and stuff between smaller groups rather than like big. I'm assuming, and it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming it's, you know, not like giant formations of units moving across. We're not recreating Gettysburg, right? We're recreating the shootout at OK Corral.
Super well put. And the shootout at the OK Corral is in fact one of the two scenarios in this book, actually. Scenario number one is you're going to refight the OK Corral fight. And in fact, a couple years before that, there's a letter in a fan zine by Gary Gygax that says, boy, I really like this Western game, but I really wish we could simulate the gunfight at the OK Corral. Can we do that with this? Can we do that? So arguably, the whole point of Boot Hill was actually to simulate specifically that gunfight. And they have it in the book.
Interesting.
So exactly that kind of skirmish level, maybe 5 or 6 people on a side, totally that.
Yeah. Yeah. Neat. So you played, you said you played some number of sessions of this game?
Yeah.
Back in the day?
Probably a campaign that ran about a year maybe or something like that.
Interesting. And, what was the thrust of the campaign, if you can remember?
Okay, the thrust of the campaign was mostly me... Gee, you'll never guess this. Was mostly me as the head of a evil bandit gang terrorizing the local town, and myself and two friends were running the Jones gang, and pretty much every other player in the campaign was trying to stop us, mostly fruitlessly. So, you know, a real stretch.
Yeah. 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 How many people were playing the campaign?
I feel like it was about 10 or a dozen, I think, totally, right?
And you had antagonistic players at the table. You had like different, you know, kind of subdivided groups.
Well, this is interesting. I'm glad you're asking this, because this is a thing I wouldn't have thought about. But we were, we were in, I think, junior high school or something like that. And so we would connect, you know, I don't think the dozen of us ever got together all at once, right? So it was actually in school. And generally speaking, like at lunch, we would contact the referee and say, here's what my characters are doing this week. I'm going to rob a stagecoach. I'm going to guard the bank. I'm going to go gamble at the hotel. And then only if, you know, antagonistic characters wound up at the same place, then we'd sit down at lunch and run the gunfight.
Fascinating. That's, I mean, it's almost kind of play by mail esque, right? Like, or it really feels like a miniatures war game, right? Like that's very reminiscent mm-hmm. to me of mm-hmm. When you and I worked together in the early aughts. I think there was someone in the office running a Warhammer campaign, and the gist was that we were, each person had an army, and there was a map, and there was context for like what the land that we're fighting over, and would maybe shoot emails or something about what our plans were, and then eventually like, oh, a fight happens, now you actually have to come, you know, schedule and come play a game. Interesting. It doesn't seem very RPG-ish to me, frankly.
Well, like I say, you know, they were kind of finding their way out of, you know, miniature war game. And I think when the early guys used the word campaign, that's what they meant, right? They meant a war game campaign where you're you know, initially trying to take over territory in a Napoleonic context or something like that.
Hmm. But you weren't playing D&D like this around the same time, were you?
That's a great question. No, that's a great question. You know, now the book sort of supports that, right? So the first edition Boot Hill book is just like, here's, and it's very miniatures heavy, right? It's things are, you know, stipulated, the ranges are stipulated in terms of inches or spaces on the tabletop. It's very miniature centric. The first edition game was just how to run a miniatures gunfight. And then the second edition expanded the book with ideas for campaigns, and more or less what we were doing was pretty much was just described in the book. So I don't think we were getting too creative about it, but the second edition game comes with a big, have it right here, big campaign map of what they call El Dorado County, right? Unlabeled. Notice that there's no words on this map, right? So the idea was you actually have to place the towns and the ranches and whatever else of interest. Wow. And then you make this county campaign your own. And we were following suit with that. Like you were saying before we started today, you know, unlike D&D, there's mostly no dungeons to go in and plunder. So you have to use some kind of outdoor campaign site to move around and make things happen.
Well, interestingly, I find like one of the reasons I think that it's so obvious that you would want to use OK Corral as your setup is when I think of like classic Western stories, whether, you know, and the many film adaptations thereof, right? A lot of classic Westerns are about a single protagonist, right? They're usually about loners, right? Which doesn't really fit the setup for a role-playing game, right? Like usually most role-playing games are about teams or squads that are going out to do stuff together. Whereas the OK Corral is the one story I can think of where you have this group, right? You have the ERPs and mm-hmm. you have Doc Hollywood and you have kind of this, a team that is operating as a team sort of, right?
Doc Holliday, yeah. And
Doc Holliday, what did I say? Doc Hollywood? That's a movie.
Very close. Okay. You're so anyway. Close.
That's hilarious. Anyway, so that's... That's fascinating to me. I never even really honestly thought about this more sort of strategic level play where you're playing big movers and potentially doing stuff against each other. Again, my main experience of playing Wild West RPGs comes much later in the 90s when I started playing Deadlands. And the way Deadlands is presented is it's an RPG set in the Wild West. Lots of the historical figures absolutely come to play, right? That's a big deal. But then there's an extra twist of there's something supernatural going on and it's a weird mystery and the players need to figure it out, right? So you kind of, the arc you're expected to play in the original Deadlands is we're playing like typical Wild West kind of stuff, but then something spooky happens and we see these weird things going on and there's this mystery and now we need to band together to figure out what the heck's going on because it's really changing the world and weird stuff is happening. And the book's very much set up that way, right? Like the book even will intentionally not tell you up front what the weird thing is, right? The way the book is written, like the players are not supposed to read past a certain point because they're not supposed to know the secret thing, right? It's supposed to all be this
classic,
you know, exciting.
Don't read the DM section. That's prohibited.
Right. Classic. Right. But it's just very interesting to me that like you're talking about something that's basically intrinsic to the setting, right? And when you had, when I tried to explain the setting to people about Deadlands, I'm like, well, it's Wild West, but there's a supernatural element, but I can't tell you what it is. Right. So that's interesting, right? I don't know. I feel like most RPGs, when you pitch them, you talk about the setting and you just give them the overarching thing of the setting and you dig into details, where Deadlands, you are specifically, you know, kind of supposed to not tell people, right? And I feel like this is sort of the era of, like, I don't know, maybe I'm going to get this wrong, but like, I think new shows like maybe Lost or X-Files were on, where, like, you're I believe it's, My read of these games was that they're trying to emulate this style of television, essentially, where each episode introduces more unanswered questions and who knows what's going on. Will we ever discover the truth? I don't know. Right. Anyway, that's I totally forgot to actually put the Deadlands image up. Anyway, there you go. Deadlands. Interesting about the footnote about Deadlands, of course, I enjoyed the crap out of this in, like, the mid-90s, like right around when it came out, around 96, 97. Played a big campaign of it. Deadlands would eventually evolve. They would extract the rules out of Deadlands into the generic RPG system of Savage Worlds. And then eventually they would re-release Deadlands Reloaded, which is the setting book for Savage Worlds that is the Deadlands world of Wild West plus supernatural stuff, which is kind of a funny circle, I think, in my head.
Nice.
You know, one thing I want to relate, though.
One,
go ahead.
Well, I mean, I played one session, right, of Deadlands, and I found that to be a very attractive concept, frankly. Maybe you can remind me what the mechanics were like. The main thing that I really liked that they used cards, for the action sequence, if I recall. And I personally, I really like when, you know, the physical artifacts are an echo of the things in the game. And I've always liked the fact that in D&D, the wizard players have to have a big book and have to be leafing through an actual book to keep track of what their spells do. Yeah. And similarly, I really like the fact that I sat down for a game of Deadlands and the randomizing element was largely cards like you'd be using in a poker game in a saloon.
Yeah, you had cards. You also specifically had a character type called the Huckster, which was sort of your magic user of the setting, who was able to evoke magical effects through card play and had to use a deck of cards to invoke their magic. And so specifically, the mechanic was to have a deck of cards at hand that they were leafing through, and the goal was to form a good poker hand. The spell was more powerful, the stronger of a poker hand you had. And then also, I believe, chips were used. Poker chips were another mechanic used in the game. Deadlands was actually fairly crunchy, I think, compared to eventually what Savage Worlds would become. Savage Worlds felt to me very much like a simplification. You know, I like that. I like simplifying rules, but I do feel like it lost some of the edge of Deadlands, of how tied the rules were to the setting, which of course makes sense, right? Because they were trying to genericize the rules to use in other settings. So Of course that's going to happen. But personally, I think if I was going to go back and run another game of Deadlands, I would be more inclined to run classic Deadlands than to, say, run Deadlands Reloaded using Savage Worlds.
Interesting. I think I might lean in the same direction. It's tough when you try to, you know, scrape the skin off and make something generic that wasn't to begin with. I agree that frequently that seems like the first edition had more raw meat to it for probably Deadlands and a bunch of other games too.
Now, I wanted to add to your anecdote of having played Deadlands, of course, was that I was DMing that game, and what you've just told me about playing Boot Hill now gives me such an interesting context in which to view that Deadlands game. Because as I recall, we had players who made characters who, in a traditional Wild West setting, are going to be a little antagonistic to each other, right? We had a railroad worker and a cowboy and a Native American warrior, right? And so we had these groups who were, like, you know, just they were going to be potentially antagonistic to each other. And I was presenting content of like, okay, there's this weird stuff going on. You're going to have to maybe investigate like what's going down at the mine. And like, no, I'm sure it's just ghost stories, but no, it turns out, no, really something spooky and mysterious is going on. But the players seem to much prefer to dig into let's fight each other and let's beat the crap out of each other because we don't trust each other. And as I recall, that game went completely off the rails, and the content presented by Deadlands, by the Deadlands adventure I was trying to run, was just swept to the side as the players decided to just screw around with each other.
I had honestly gotten hazy over exactly what happened in that session, as a matter of fact. To be clear, I wasn't playing any one of those characters that Paul just mentioned. I was actually playing an 1800s veterinarian, which I thought was a clever twist, but didn't tie into the other characters super duper well. So in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, maybe that wasn't the best choice.
I mean, none of the characters tied into each other, and somehow we had missed the expectation of you guys are going to work together to solve a mystery like that. We lost sight of that, and it more just became Sandbox Wild West World. Let's beat each other up.
I honestly feel like this was in a phase of our player group, like, figuring that out, honestly, for both D&D and other games like Deadlands. And I think that within the next year or two, which is about 30 years into my gaming experience, I was like, you know what? There should be a policy whereby the players kind of find reasons to work together regardless of what their character idea was. Yeah, that's a really, wow, what a novel idea. I'm glad I came up with that, I said to myself. So slow. You should say yes. You should say yes to the other characters' decisions and work as a group.
Work as a group. Fascinating. Yeah. But I would say, frankly, a setting like Wild West is less likely to encourage that kind of play, right? I mean, it's the Wild West, right? We're supposed to be looking out for number one, and there's no laws to govern us, and we're going to shoot each other, and that's so be it. So I almost think the kind of campaign you're talking about from Boot Hill maybe works better, where the players are going to do whatever the heck they want, and they're potentially going to become antagonistic towards each other, and that's fun.
It's interesting that the shift there is, if you look at Dave Arneson's Blackmoor game, from what we understand about it, right? This shift from, actual wargaming campaigns where the players are potentially antagonistic to each other and trying to beat each other, right? There is this awkward moment where you're shifting to the Lord of the Rings style party of contrasts working together. And it's interesting that this early point, I mean, in some sense, it takes a lot of effort away from the referee of like, okay, you made your play, you players, you made your characters, you tell me what you do, and I'm going to tell you when you're in conflict. That's basically the entirety of me running a campaign, versus the DM having to craft scenarios and episodes and interesting encounters to take control of all of the bad guys, which is, arguably more work.
Yeah. I mean, it's. I feel very conflicted about this because the content of Deadlands is very appealing to me. I love this idea of we're going to play in this historical setting, and we're going to dig into that for a little bit, but then we're going to discover something weird is going on and there's a mystery to solve. I enjoy that. That sounds fun to me. That said, I think the problem with Deadlands and, frankly, much of the Savage Worlds content that I started digging into around the early aughts was that it got very railroady, right? A lot of the content I was reading, they had this whole concept of plot point paths, right? And they were trying really hard to craft content that was not going to necessarily railroad the players, right? You can do this stuff in any order and you can mix and mash it up, but still all these things have to happen and the plot must unfold. Right. And I was like, yeah, there's a real push pull there for me of, I'm not sure. Like, it would be nice if it rolls out the way that the authors were hoping it would, but I feel like you're gambling. There's a good chance it just all falls to pieces and you don't get quite the experience you were hoping for.
At least one of our patrons has said, and other people point this out, the idea, D&D's idea of having a dungeon, right, at least limits the amount of content that the DM has to make, is you're literally constrained by the physical structure, mm-hmm. and you're designing a space that's at least finite. And when the players go into it, most of the time, you know, they've got two or three tunnels to take. Those are the choices. If you and at least one of our patrons has said that they've had somebody else that was playing other role-playing games and then came to D&D, played their first dungeon fairly late in their experience, and had this light bulb moment of, oh, this makes so much sense. This makes so much sense to focus what our choices are, and in a very concrete space, pardon me, and that actually made for a very nice campaign, actually constricting the choices. When you remove that and you throw the game into the wide world, like the entire Wild West, and the players can go anywhere, you kind of do suddenly have this problem where the referee has to find other reasons to constrain how much content they're actually making. Because if you can actually say, just go anywhere you want in the Wild West and tell me what you do, that's an almost unbearable load for the DM.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. And then I think you by contrast, you then see some content coming out. I'm trying to remember where I saw this, but like, I'm reminded of a game that was a sci-fi game whose gist was that you were asteroid miners or people hired by the asteroid mining company to go deal with problems. And so you're flying around in your sci-fi, you know, spaceship, and you land on an asteroid and you go into the mines. And I'm like, and so it's become a dungeon crawl, right? Like it is dungeons in outer space is what it becomes. And I'm like, that's interesting. It's funny. It's weird. I don't know. Does it feel a little forced? But maybe it's really good, frankly. Maybe it's really good because it lets you explore all those sci-fi tropes, but still be in the constraint of you're in a dungeon. There's tunnels. They go left and right. Which way do you want to go?
It's interesting. I totally wrote a scenario for the sci-fi Star Frontiers game that was almost exactly what you just described. So that's kind of interesting. Yeah. You know, but the downside is that you do run into these like railroady type plot situations, and I agree with you. They kind of grind my gears the same way.
So do we have that for Wild West? Is there a Wild West in the dungeon game out there?
Well, I don't know a particular game. So for what it's worth, Boot Hill Second Edition did have a series of modules that they, you know, adventure modules that they made, maybe about half a dozen after the fact. And I did throw up one image. One of them is called The Lost Conquistador Mine, I believe is what the name of it is. So here's the, and you know, interestingly, again, 85% of this adventure is in the outdoors. So 85% of it is a wilderness adventure trying to find the lost conquistador mine. And then, to a 40-year-old adventure module. So it's at some point you do actually, you know, hopefully if things go right, you do actually find the mine. And then it does, in fact, actually sort of turn into a dungeon crawl, as a matter of fact. Not a huge one. But I think that was like the second adventure module for Boot Hill. And it, you know, that has the feel of a lot of D&D modules, like in the Expert series, right? Where you've got the first half is a wilderness adventure to find the lost temple, and then the second half is the actual temple or something like that. That's actually how a lot of D&D adventures were being made at the time.
Sure. I mean, and conversely, we've tried to take D&D in the other direction when we talk about wilderness adventures and the stuff you've done with outdoor spoliation, right? Where you're like, yep, it's not a dungeon, specifically not a dungeon. It's a big open world. Yeah. Crawl around on a map.
Yeah.
Have we done? Wait, sorry. Now it's coming to me, Dan. I mean, you need the outdoor survival board, right? Outdoor survival board, but we're going to change what the icons are into towns and mines and, you know, I don't know what else exists in the Wild West. farms, what have you.
Yep. There ranches. You go. Yep.
Yep. Branches, yeah,
right. That's well. I mean, that's more or less what they right. That's more or less what they gave you, right? I mean, interestingly, they gave you this map, right, with nothing labeled on it, just like Outdoor Survival doesn't have anything labeled on it.
There you go.
So, to a large extent, right, that's what they were trying to. Now, frankly, I will say the map's not as nearly as interesting as the Outdoor Survival map. Actually, the Outdoor Survival has all kinds of little details and corners and cranks and interesting, you know, barriers. And this is kind of like more realistic, frankly. But a lot of large open nothingness to a large degree. So, which is another thing that we wrestle with. Which one's more interesting, realistic topography or interesting fantasy topography?
Yeah.
I guess really the latter is what I've come to. Now, I will say this. Okay, so...
Yeah.
one of the things with, you know, with the Wild West genre is, you know, how heavily do you make it historical, right? So I was attracted to Boot Hill with their fairly high attention to historical figures and places and the specific dates that different firearms came into existence, right? It's like if you're in playing 1875, you have these guns, but you don't have these guns. And the adventure modules likewise try to lean pretty heavily into, you know, what the Wild West really was. I get that. Reading through some of those adventure modules recently, a lot of people, I think, would be unwilling to play them because, you know, the setting has so much misogyny and racism, you know, built into it by default, because that's what the Wild West was. So The characters and the towns, right, it's all run by men. Women don't really have any say in what's going on. Particular Native American tribes are held out as purely hostile, and the U.S. Army purely hostile against the Native Americans. So, and the other thing with the genre is that, of course, it's fairly, what, you know, some of our commenters right now in the live chat are like, how many, you know, gunfights between man on man on man on man are going to be super interesting, right? You have a fairly thin monster manual, I guess is what I'll say. So you can kind of see why the fantasy genre is much more open-ended, with much more deep things. You can change the world. You can change the context. You can, you know, fine-tune what elements you appreciate. You can have a lot of fantastical monsters. Whereas the Wild West genre, yeah, you're going to be fighting basically people, and you have about 2% of the depth of content that you have doing something like fantasy. So we played for about a year, which I think was good. We were talking to James Malaszewski last week about him running a 7-year campaign. We know some people that say they've been running 20-year campaigns. I'm not sure you could hold out like a Western game running that long. I'm not sure if that would be feasible.
I feel like possibly you've just outlined like Dan's theory on the origins of steampunk. Like there, thus steampunk. I mean, that's what I like about Deadlands, sense, frankly.
Right?
It has limited monster manual, but in Deadlands we get zombies and monsters and all kinds of horrible, weird things to encounter. And it's fun playing in a setting where those weird things are on the fringes. And you come back to town, and the people are highly skeptical of the nonsense that you claim to have encountered. Is enjoyable.
I consider that move very Liberian, is what I call that. The very Liberian or Vancian mode of you go see something supernatural, and the people back in town just don't believe you is very, or even your characters don't believe it either. The characters themselves actually encountered it and make up reasons why that was fake. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense, right? It makes a lot of sense to bring in, like, you know, deep, to expand it and bring it in deeper. And I'll just make a little bit of a tangent, is that, you know, very, very early on, you know, Gygax and friends were doing the same thing with their Boot Hill and their D&D games, right? And they were mixing it up, and we've talked other days about, you know, throwing your characters to another dimension, which is actually another game campaign, actually. Right, and they were doing that very frequently. There is a little bit of history, right? So when TSR was initially founded to publish D&D, right, there were three founders. There was Gary Gygax, there was Brian Bloom, and there was Don Kay, three friends. And unfortunately, within the year of D&D being published, Don Kay passed away, which was a big, big blow to the business. And arguably, as a result, the majority control actually fell to the Blooms. And ultimately, that's why Gygax was actually lost control of the company, kicked out. And if Don Kay had lived a longer time, probably the story of the business of TSR would be radically different from what it turned out to be, as a matter of fact. But Don Kay was obsessed with the Wild West. Don Kay loved the Wild West. That was his favorite role-playing genre, actually. To my understanding, he really pushed the creation of the Boot Hill rules, really pushed for that to be the next game that TSR published. And he had a character in Gygax's Greyhawk campaign named Merlin, who was a wizard and would routinely travel back and forth between the D&D world and the Boot Hill world. And so Merlin would actually wind up in the Greyhawk D&D campaign, a wizard dressed as a Wild West fighter carrying six guns and walking around routinely shooting the monsters with six shooters instead of his spells, right? And you can, and Merlin is, you know, shows up in the Greyhawk books in exactly that way. And of course, Gygax has to make a rule. Well, he has a special aura, right? You can't just take his six shooters away and use them. He's got a special aura that allows him to use gunpowder and things like that. But Don Kay was so committed to Wild West play that even his D&D wizard ultimately became a Boot Hill fighter.
That's funny.
So they've got, right, so very early on, they've got, when it was more common to mix and match the games, right, they have conversion rules, right? So my second edition Boot Hill has the very last page here has conversion rules on how to convert your Boot Hill characters to Dungeons and Dragons, right? And here's the two hit changes and how you're going to do saving throws and all that kind of stuff.
Out of curiosity, Dan, because again, my Wild West gaming all revolves around Deadlands, where clearly they were trying to invent their own system. How close to D&D mechanically is Boot Hill?
Not whatsoever. Completely not related in almost any way whatsoever. Yeah. They do have ability scores, right? In fact, I have an image of that. I've got Boot Hill. It's got like two tables on it.
Is it perhaps this one?
That's the giant list of historical figures, actually. So if you can find one that's got two tables, one above the other, that's it. Okay, so here's two of the initial ability score tables. You got six abilities. I think they're speed, accuracy, bravery, strength, which is really hit points, actually, and then experience. And you can see it's rolled with percentile dice. And you can see, like on the lower table under accuracy, right? You have a roll percentile dice. You get a description for your accuracy, like fair or good or very good. And then you have an ability score that's like maybe -3 or +7 or +10. And so the mechanics of combat are that you have a 50% chance to hit, modified by your ability score there. So if I have very good accuracy, my base percentage to hit is going to be like 60% plus some other modifiers and stuff like that. And you roll your percentile dice, and of course you try to roll low under the indicated percent to hit. So that's obviously different dice, different abilities, actually upside down versus standard D&D mechanics. And it's very, very, very different. So the conversion rules have to really bend the mechanics a lot. I think if you transfer to D&D, they just kind of wave their hands and go, now you're a second level fighter. and if there's other ability scores, you better roll for them, I guess. And then you just start using D&D rules, basically. And they have to have, totally different rules for damage. So in Boot Hill, there's a wound chart. I don't know if you can pull that up. It's like going to be one small table. I feel like that might be interesting, actually. Kind of one small. So here's the wound chart, right? You get shot. And then you roll percentile dice for location, left leg, left shoulder, or head. And then once you figure that out, you roll percentile dice to see whether you have a light wound, a serious wound that reduces your strength, or you're just immediately dead. So any character of any experience level, right, you might get shot in the head, and if I roll 50 after that, then you're just instantly dead. And that's, I think we agree, very different from standard D&D.
Yeah.
So very, very different.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely mechanically, and the kinds of dice you're rolling and the kinds of stats you have definitely seem very different. I mean, it's not to say that there aren't plenty of instances in D&D where you could die on a single die roll, but generally not straight up combat, I suppose. Not your normal combat, but don't know, save or die, certainly a thing.
Sure. Yep, that's true. That's true. You, I mean, I think we agree usually in D&D, at least once you get to a particular level, right, you're more robust, and a standard fighter is not going to come up and immediately kill you most of the time. But in Boot Hill, that's always a possibility, no matter how much experience you get.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's interesting how willing they were to have, right, completely customized mechanics for different games, depending on the genre. And then if you get thrown into the other campaign, they basically just could scrub the whole thing away and go, well, now you're playing with completely different mechanics and that's what we do. There's one detail that I cannot help but point out. I pointed out, I think, on Twitter the other day. So there's a, can you pull up the, I have an image of the conversion rules, actually. And it's got a table at the bottom. It's mostly text, and there's a table at the bottom.
Perhaps it's this one.
Yeah, nope. Right there. Yeah. Okay. So it's totally that. So there's a slice of the conversion rules. You can see in that table at the bottom, right, the weapons all just turn into D&D style damage. So, mm-hmm. you know, like other handgun. In Boot Hill, you'd go to that table and have a pretty good chance of just immediately killing somebody. In D&D, a six shooter now just does 1d8 damage, which is a big, big difference in capacity.
It's really odd. And I remember that. I feel like that's like any time I've dealt with a fantasy game trying to introduce, you know, guns, you know, black powder anything like that, there's always this problem, this discrepancy where some players are like, I mean, single gunshot to the head should just kill you, versus the like, no, it should play by the rules of other, you know, systems, and therefore there should be damage rolls. And then you end up with, well, my 10th level fighter can just take six direct hits from a cannon, and that's fine. Right? <You're> like, really?
Right.
Okay. All right. Seems weird.
It's a real fault line between your expectations of those genres, and everybody still debates that nowadays. The thing that and of course, you know, this slice of conversion rules, it appears in this Boot Hill book, and then it basically appears, I almost copy pasted into the first edition DM's guide too. And it's under the interesting heading, when it appears in the DM's guide, it says six guns in sorcery, how to convert your D&D characters to Boot Hill. And, you know, I use that for the subtitle of this episode, as a matter of fact. And one of our patrons pointed out there was a game that used that title, was like 1986, 1996, something like that, right, called Six Guns and Sorcery. And I don't really know very much else about the book, but sounds very similar to Deadlands. You're bringing in your Wild West tropes and then adding magical supernatural stuff to add spice.
I mean, let's be honest, right? This is the origin of D&D. It was a historical medieval war game, and they were like, "Well, let's throw in some dragons and wizards."
Good point. So I'll apologize, but the thing that I must point out in the conversion rules, right? I don't know if you can go back to that.
Yeah, sure.
And this is so me, and I apologize to everybody for this. So right in the middle there, it says distance and scale conversions, right? So the Boot Hill scale in every edition, first edition, second edition, right? The Boot Hill scale was 1 inch is 6 feet, right? And we all know classically the D&D indoor scale was 1 inch equals 10 feet. So Boot Hill, 1 inch equals 6 feet. D&D, 1 inch equals 10 feet. And then here it says distance and scale conversion. Boot Hill inches equal inches in D&D and AD&D. They are the same. Right. And at least Dan's brain is like, oh God, you're giving me this Lovecraftian non-Euclidean geometry bullshit.
I mean, the text even then goes on to hammer down how Boot Hill inches are 2 meters. In GW and MA, what is that referring to?
Gamma World and Metamorphosis Alpha.
There you go. Okay.
Which are your early TSR, kind of, sort of, post-apocalyptic, sci-fi-y D&D, very close to D&D games.
Yeah.
So that's an axe I tend to like to grind, is that D&D coming out of Arsene said that one inch was 10 feet, but actually all the immediately following games from TSR use this 1 inch equals 6 feet, which matches the miniature scale. That's the scale they used for Warriors of Mars, That's the scale used for Boot Hill. And personally, I feel that's kind of obviously what the scale should have been. Mm-hmm. And here's Gygax trying to pretend that that was what the scale was all along to match the miniatures. Should have just fixed that, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, can't admit to having made a mistake.
Exactly. But from now on, having noticed this recently, I am going to go around and tell everybody officially the scale in D&D is 1 inch equals 6 feet, because he wrote it more than once in two different books. He said the Boot Hill inches are equal to D&D inches. So as far as I'm concerned, they're 6 feet each. problem solved. I'm glad you all agree with me.
Excellent. So I feel like, as I think about modern, and I'm trying to think of, like, I'm trying to extrapolate now into more modern gaming, and I feel like maybe the Wild West genre is not as popular these days as it was back then.
I agree, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of a like, what game came out in the last 5 years that has a Wild West theme, and not coming up with any.
That's a good question. Anybody in the chat have an example of that? Recent Wild West games? Yeah, I'm kind of drawing a blank myself.
Right. I know that there's some, thinking about, there's a story game that I remember hearing about that was popular when I was listening to the Durham 3 podcast, but even that's like a good 10 years old. So I guess, maybe it's just not as popular as a setting in general, in popular culture at the moment, right?
I think you're right. I have Mike D in the chat is coming up with something. Here it is. A couple of people kind of orbited around this. I guess it's a game called Dead Man's Hand, which is a miniature skirmish game. Very similar to Boot Hill is what it sounds like. I hadn't heard of that. So, Mike, thank you for that. A couple of people are pointing out computer games, right? Like Red Dead Redemption, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's also, if you look at the recent reprinting of Fiasco, there is a playset called Boomtown, which emulates a Wild West setting. But if you think back to when D&D was coming out in the mid-70s, of course, Westerns were kind of in their heyday, right? Or mm-hmm. maybe at the tail end of their heyday at that point.
That's a pretty good point, actually, right?
Yeah.
A lot of movies, a lot of, Sergio Leone spaghetti Westerns at that time. That's a good point, actually.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yep. Now, I feel I should do a little bit of a payoff from the teaser that I had at the start of the show, actually, about the argument that maybe Wild West games were actually the very first role-playing game. And some of us have been debating that in the chat, reasonably so. Where is this point? What was the first role-playing game? Well, there was this evolution from war games. And our friend, John Peterson with his book calls this the elusive shift. It's hard to find exactly where it came. And part of it was, playing and inhabiting one single role instead of an army or a battalion or something like that. That crept into the gaming. One element was characters gaining experience and improving between sessions. And that's, maybe the most important part, actually, possibly. So where did that first start? And some people can point to Mike Carr's Fight in the Skies World War I game, right? It's a war game, but you're controlling one plane, and therefore you're also controlling one pilot, and therefore it was kind of obvious to start adding experience to your pilots from session to session. But big thanks to our patron Josh, because he pointed to a blog post by our friend John Peterson that I did not know about before, is in 1970, there was a game called Western Gunfight. And so 1970, right? So this is 4 years before D&D came out, and written by three guys there, Curtis, Colwell, and Black, who ironically are from Bristol in the United Kingdom. And they were really enthusiastic about American Wild West gaming. And so they made this game here called the Western Gunfight War Game Rules. Again, years before the role-playing game term came up. So they present this as a war game, but in, you know, in the first edition you're looking at, they had a second edition come out a couple of years later. When they're writing about it, they were saying things like, now this is a new kind of thing, and you should be really thinking about inhabiting your one single fighter, which is kind of new. And you know what? Even if it's disadvantageous in the rules, if your character is motivated to do a particular thing, you ought to make choices according to your character's mental state. And in fact, they themselves start to go, now, some people might possibly complain that this isn't actually a war game anymore, but maybe yes, maybe no, and we don't know what it would be if it's not a war game. So they themselves start debating over the fact that they don't have a term for this war gamey thing that's evolving into something else. So I thought that was a very interesting find by John Peterson. Big thanks to Josh for pointing that out. Yeah, 1970, yeah, 4 years before D&D.
Never heard of it. Now, where does that land? I'm trying to remember. When does Brownstein happen?
Good. Around the same time, right?
Right. I'm trying to find a date really quickly. October 1970, maybe? 71? 70, 71, maybe? Yeah. So around the same time, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Fascinating.
Yep. And clearly, we know that Gygax knew about this game because he was talking about it in a letter to Wargamer's newsletter at the time, actually. And this is actually the game where he said, geez, it would be nice if we could have a list of historical figures in statistics for this game. And I really wish that we could play out the gunfight at the OK Corral. And that is what you get in Boot Hill. So it's a pretty clear, obvious inspiration for the Boot Hill game and other role play type stuff. So you could possibly point at this and make an argument that right there was the first actual role playing game before you had the word for it. Maybe. I can see that.
I mean, amusingly, sorry. So Stephen Wendell is correcting me because that Brownstein was in 69, which is absolutely right. Because now I'm looking at the Wikipedia article because I was just trying to find the date. And the funny thing, side note, where I came up with October 70 is that in 1970, Dwayne Jenkins ran a series of Wild West Brownsteins called Brownstone that was set in Brownstone, Texas. So that's amusing. Immediately, there you go. Even if you say that Brownstein is the first RPG, like pretty much immediately we get the Wild West version after the fantasy version.
Right, right. They were very closely tied in. There's a question here from Jerry McDonald also pointing out to the price on the cover of Western Gunfight Rules, which is of course in pence. And you're right, Jerry, that was English, right? The guys writing that were in Bristol, which I find surprising, but sometimes you need a perspective outside the culture to actually get a really good grip on a particular context, actually. And apparently that was, I mean, I don't know enough about currency. Apparently that was at a moment where they were converting from one type of pence to another type of pence in England, but that's beyond my numismatic knowledge.
Well, we're close here to the end of time, Dan. So, you got any final thoughts on Wild West role playing games?
It's interesting that, you know, some people say that a game like D&D is largely Wild West plot tropes with more stuff skinned around it, and you can point to things like the recent Star Wars series on Disney by Jon Favreau, right? Very, very Wild West feel to it. Very Wild West plots, and if you do get out of the dungeon, it's quite likely that your the plots that the DM makes might possibly have a feel of Wild West type, you know, weapons, people with weapons on their own, independent in some kind of wilderness area. has a very closely tied legacy, tied right at the hip, right from the beginning of role playing games in D&D. Interesting that, you know, Don Kay was such a motivating force for that kind of thing at the time. For me, I think it's interesting how really closely we were to having roll low mechanics as the basis for our games. Is, you know, D&D has roll high on a d20 for attacks, but most everything else in the game is roll low on a d6. So finding secret doors and opening doors and listening to things, most everything else is actually a roll low mechanic. And a game like Boot Hill, you know, that has a roll low percentile mechanic, in some ways, it's actually a little bit more elegant to be able to say, you have a 60% chance of success at this, and then roll low on percentile dice. And there are some days when I actually kind of wish that the D&D system used that scale and used that mechanic, actually, because some days I actually feel it's a little bit more elegant. How about you, Paul? What's your take on Dan's
arguments for roll low? Yeah, and fascinating. I don't know. Have
you not read my blog, people? Have you not read my blog on this issue? I clearly put the issue to rest.
You know, after a conversation, my brain is still spinning on sort of like where the intersection. Like, how do I take all of the lessons I've learned from digging into old school D&D and apply those to a Wild West game? Because I haven't played a Wild West game since the early 90s when I was playing a very different style of game. I'm very actually intrigued now by the idea of how do I, say, take something like Outdoor Spoliation and adapt that into a Wild West game. Can I play Deadlands on the outdoor survival board? I think that would actually be super fun. Like, play a very sandbox style Wild West game, but still with the trope of your group as a team trying to figure out the big mystery that's going on here. And frankly, I think that's very easily solvable by doing something that I simply never would have crossed my mind back in the 90s, which is just say that to the players. Just say, we're playing a game where you guys are working as a team to solve a big mystery. The end.
Yep. Right. Yeah, there was a point where I think for our playgroup where I kind of smacked myself on the head. It's like, why did we not ever realize that we needed to say that out loud?
Because, I don't know, man, it's just role play. It's just play your character. We're just going to.
My character wouldn't do that, though, Paul. My character would not do that. I'm just playing my character.
Oh God! All right,
things we never need to hear again.
Yeah. Viewers, if you know of any Wild West games that we missed, are there arguments for or against how it might have been the first or second ever RPG, or other modern Wild West game? Because that was a kind of a question that came up that we just sort of blanked on. By the way, the one I came up with, the one I was thinking of earlier, it was Dogs in the Vineyard. That's 2004. Oh. That's how old that one is. If you have a Wild West game that's a much more modern Wild West game, leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. Tell us what we missed, and maybe we'll return to the Wild West topic in the future.
Yeah, and if you're maybe some comments, if you're pro decimal or you're pro base 12, we would like to hear that as well, or at least I would. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, Facebook, GitHub, TikTok, and we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So look for us there and updates on upcoming shows.
If you prefer to listen to the show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those podcasts on our website at wanderingdms.com. Or through various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us there. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show. Give us ideas for topics like today. Tell us about games we didn't even know about, like Western Gunfight or other stuff that came up today. And if you'd like to join our patrons and their generous support, please visit patreon.com/wanderinggames. You'll see our different tiers, different benefits you get, in particular, access to our Discord server where we always have monthly behind-the-scenes chat ongoing about all of our shows and all of our different games. And in particular, right after our Sunday show, we have a continuing conversation on video on Discord. So we hope that you'll join us, and we'll get to see your face when we continue the conversation in about 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be some very interesting stuff on that discussion today. A lot of ideas percolating for games that I don't have time to run. But yeah, definitely, you know, pitch a dollar into the Patreon or five if you really like us. And you know, come join us. It's a good time. It's a good conversation at the end of the show every day on Sunday or every week on Sunday.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And upcoming shows this week, I'll be shifting to Thursdays for my Dan Plays Games from the Elder Times streaming PC Games Live. And I think this week I'm going to start digging into one of the AD&D Gold Box games that I've never actually played before. So you're going to see, as if the last game wasn't hard enough. As if my troubles with Dungeon Hack wasn't bad enough, now I'm actually going to start banging my head live in public on a game that I've never played before. So please tune in and help me. I'm probably going to need it Thursday night at 11. But the thing I really want to point out is that I'm personally very excited about the guest that we're going to be having next week, which will be Sunday, May 29th. We're going to have Kieran Gillen, who is one of my favorite comic book authors working today. And Kieran has been the author of comic books like Warhammer, and he's written the X-Men and Thor and the Eternals. And he just recently wrapped up his 20-issue series called Die, which occurs in a fantasy world. It's very gaming related. And Kieran felt compelled to make a custom role-playing game called Die that feeds into that comic book series. And I know he's been working on it for a couple of years, actually. That's going to be released pretty soon. And I'm personally really looking forward to speaking with Kieran Gillen next week about his Die role-playing game.
Awesome. Please join us.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So that's next week. And of course, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.